spoke about Fear Shattering Myths, if you recall yesterday in the second half of the program, we turned our attention to a prophecy that is presented on our behalf beginning in the 17th chapter of Yeshayah, Isaiah, and running through the 18th. And it commences with a declaration regarding Damascus. So we began examining the other places where Damascus was introduced, what God's perspective was on Damascus. We recognized that Damascus not only was excluded from the covenant, but also that Damascus, in league with other nations, sought to destroy the apple of God's eye, which is Yehuda and Jerusalem, and God said it isn't going to happen that way. He also even discussed in these previous prophecies the alliances that were formed between Damascus and the northern kingdom that led to the demise of the northern kingdom, referred to as Ephraim. At that point, we turned our attention to a prophecy that is found in the 7th chapter of Yeshayah, 10 chapters before this one regarding Damascus's fall. When Damascus comes back up again, and God is speaking of an alliance now, that he is asking the king of Yehuda to avoid. He's saying, you know, you're going to be a lot better off if you rely on me rather than relying on political or military solutions. Don't rely on diplomacy in this case. Rely on me and things will work out for you. And so when Ahaz tried to promote that with his people, rather than reading the Torah and learning how what God had already done for them and determining for themselves by studying the Torah that Yahweh was always dependable, they must have asked him for a sign, because Yahweh says, you know, the people ask me for a sign. And Ahaz is saying, hey, man, God, I'm not asking you for a sign. I know who you are. I know what you can do. But, yeah, it's right. The people have. And so God said, all right, I'll give you a sign. And the first sign that he gave them is, he said, please listen, family of Dod, of beloved family, if you will. Question whether, from so few, it would be possible that men would be so capable, except with their God. Now, this should have resonated throughout time. When the kingdom of Israel was established, with Egypt to the west, the Hittites to the north, the Assyrians and Babylonians to the east, should have been a time where it was unlikely to the point of impossible that a nation could exist independent with so few people in the crossroads between these powers. And yet it did. And then when the superpowers of the world tried to attack Israel, history repeatedly showed that was when God was with them, when they, more importantly, were with God, when they honored the terms and conditions of the covenant, when they took the time to be Torah observant so they knew who Yahweh was and what he was offering and capable of, that it didn't matter that the Egyptians wanted to destroy them. It didn't matter that the Assyrians wanted to destroy them. They were safe. It's only when they chose to depend on their military, on their diplomacy, that they were ravaged. And so God asked this question. How would it be possible? And today we have to ask ourselves this question. After the Israelites came to try to drive the Roman Empire out of Yehuda in 133 CE, and the Romans had to send in not one but three legions to suppress this revolt. And it was a revolt led by rabbis who have no relationship of any kind with God. In fact, they're as opposed to God as were the pagans in the Roman legions. And the Romans not only destroyed Israel as a nation, they salted the land. They hauled many of the men off into slavery. Those who had actually rebelled, they crucified on the way out of town. They raised the city. Even renamed the place to dissuade future rebellions based upon a longing for the land. And even in spite of that, and the Jews being hauled off into slavery, now another time, you know, after the Assyrians had done it, the Babylonians had done it, the Egyptians prior to that had done it, and now the Romans were doing it, beginning 2,000 years, really, of being dispersed throughout the world, that even after a Holocaust, God brought his people back. There was a remnant of his people, and that the land was recolonized with his people. How would that be possible? With a population that represents less than 0.2% of the world's population, that they would be able to prevail in this way. That's why God is asking this question. It is a question that the world should be asking. If it were not for God, how would they even exist? They're outnumbered right now 100-1 by Muslims who want to destroy them. They're outgunned by those Muslims now 25-1. How do they survive if not for God? The question we should be asking when the world wants to rely on diplomatic solutions that involve slicing up Israel and giving it to the Muslims who want to destroy the place, politicians ought to be asking, wait a minute, if not for God, they would already be gone. Do we want to side and oppose God, side against and oppose God? Why would we want to do that? Isn't that stupid? The next line is, therefore, accordingly, Yahweh himself, he bestowed this to me. This is what Yahshayah, Isaiah, is saying that God told him. Behold, the sign of a pregnant virgin when giving birth to a son. Indeed, his name shall be proclaimed Emmanuel. That was a pretty impressive sign. Now, the first sign was all that was necessary for the king to choose to rely on Yahweh as opposed to diplomacy, which had failed the northern kingdom. The second sign was for us. A pregnant virgin. That was impossible then. It's highly infrequent now. You know, artificial insemination, there is a extraordinarily small intersection of virgins who are pregnant. You know, most who use artificial insemination are married and just unable to conceive the old-fashioned way. And so it's extraordinarily uncommon now. It was impossible then. Then God said, that's the sign. A virgin is going to be pregnant. But that's not the whole sign. This virgin is going to become pregnant, and the son that she's going to conceive is going to be called God with us, Emmanuel. That's a pretty extraordinary event. Among the ordinary things that happen in life, I would have to say that's a fairly extraordinary occurrence. And that is indeed what happened when a child was born and a son was given to us, which is what Yahshayah is inspired to write by Yahweh two chapters hence in the ninth chapter of this prophetic testimony, explaining the nature of this child, Emmanuel, of God with us. A child was born, a son is given. Now, as we look at all of this, recognizing that this prophecy of the arrival of God with us is commencing out of Damascus, just as this prophecy in the 17th chapter commences in Damascus, we are in a position where God with us, Emmanuel, and the 9th chapter, which explains that this child which is born, the son which is given, will be Almighty God. He will be the Father. That At that point, we're not just talking about his most recent advent in 33 CE, in year 4000, yeah, but also of his return, when God's going to be with us for 1,000 years. In fact, Emmanuel is what he's going to be called upon his return. It wasn't what he was called during his last visit. So this prophecy coming out of Damascus, as it does, is speaking of what's going to happen in year 6000 Yah, in 2033, which is the culminating event for what this next prophecy in Yeshayah 17 and 18 portends. So by reviewing the references to Damascus, which lead now to Yahweh's return as our Heavenly Father, as God with us for 1,000 years, all coming out of Damascus, we now see what is going to emerge next out of Damascus that leads the world to this point. Now, more fully aware of the contrast between what man has done to himself in Damascus and the work Yahweh has done on our behalf, particularly in Jerusalem, which is where this prophecy, this last one, culminated. Let's ponder a remarkable end times prophecy. In the midst of one of the most horrific, religiously inspired proxy wars of all time, one that is being played out before our very eyes in Syria, we are warned. A prophetic pronouncement regarding Damascus. Behold, Damascus is revolting and corrupt, and will be removed from among inhabited cities. And she shall totally and actually become a twisted and tangled heap of rubble. This is Yeshayah, Isaiah, which means salvation is from Yahweh, 17:1. It begins with the Hebrew word masa. Masa means that this statement is regarding something that's going to happen in the future. It is a pronouncement of future history. Damascus, which is a borrowed word, is from Dama, which is weeping sore, and Dima, which is tears of sorrow, and Domen, corpses covered in dung. So as we consider the beginning of this statement, Yeshayah, Isaiah 17:1, God is saying this is a prophetic pronouncement. We talked about this a bit yesterday. It always is worthy of repetition. God is not predicting the future. This prophecy was revealed in around 750 BCE, 2,750 years ago. We have a copy of this manuscript, of this prophecy, that dates all the way back to 250 BCE. But it's not a prediction. God's not playing Nostradamus here. You know, Nostradamus throws out a bunch of kind of vague statements, and that after the fact they can be interpreted, and they're never predictive of anything because they're too nebulous to be to actually warn you of anything, and they're only looked at in arrears and said, okay, maybe that was could have been talking about this, particularly if you take it out of context and you throw everything else away. And God makes all of his prophecies are in context. And they are ascribed to a specific period of time, as is this one. But God's not predicting the future. He's revealing the future. He has already seen it. That's the nature of being light. The nature of being energy-based is that you aren't stuck in time like we are. You know, we're three-point-something dimensional creatures. We exist in time, but we can't maneuver in time. Yahweh can. We will one day as well. So he has witnessed our future. That does not predestine us to that future, but it is the future that will occur. And the reason that's the case is what God is reporting is the sum total of all of our choices. We make a lot of bad ones. And so the sum total of all of our choices, orchestrated under the auspices of free will, lead to what he has seen and thus is reporting in our past. So it is very much future history that we are reading when we consider this. Now, Damascus is not yet destroyed, but it's going to be. And what's interesting here is that the Damascus of 750 BCE could not be destroyed as a heap of twisted and tangled material. You cannot twist and tangle stone. That's how the buildings were built. They were built of stone. You can twist and tangle steel girders. And if you look at Damascus now in the pictures, the images of twisted and tangled buildings because of the way that the steel support systems within those buildings are contorted. And the rubble kind of hanging together by the twisted and contorted, tangled steel that is within those structures. Now, Damascus itself is an interesting term. It means a weeping sore, means tears of sorrow, corpses covered in dung. That's a kind of a strong visual image. But corpses covered in dung is a very consistent image from Yahweh's perspective of religious and political individuals. God says if you are devoid of the Torah, if you do not consider his teaching, then your prayer comes to him as an abomination, and he sees you as having dung all over your appearance. God actually uses the term that we can't say on this program about the excrement that comes from the south side of a bull heading north. And it's the term that he uses to describe religion and what religion does to individuals. And the reason he uses that term, bull, is because the bull is a principal manifestation of the adversary, of false gods. It was and the constellation of Taurus, the bull, that the sun is in during the spring equinox, when the pagan world celebrated the resurrection, if you will, of the son of the sun and the impregnation of the Queen of Heaven and Mother of God on Easter, so that 9 months later the son of the sun could be born. It's the basis of Christmas and Easter in Christianity. So God speaks of these things as referencing both the bull and the dung from the bull to describe the effect of these religious lies on their hosts. What do they do to them? How they corrupt them? How he sees them as smelly and stinky and disgusting. It's how God views those who yabber on to him with their wish list of what they want, giving him credit for all manner of things that he has nothing to do with, who won't even bother to read his teaching, his instructions, as they're presented in his Torah. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. So in this, the name of Dramesk, as it is pronounced in Hebrew, what we find is that we have a place that is been given the name of weeping sore, tears of sorrow, corpses covered in dung, where the people grow dumb and are silenced. Pretty depictive and descriptive of what we're witnessing. Then he says, behold. Behold is henna. It's a very important Hebrew word. It's the word actually that appears twice in Yahweh's name. Pay attention. Look up. Behold. Be observant. Notice this. This is important. It's the letter that is a word that is the only letter and thus word that appears twice in Yahweh's name. It was originally drawn as two people standing up, reaching up, looking up, paying attention to, being observant regarding God. So he says, behold, Damascus is revolting and corrupt and will be removed from among inhabited cities. Sur men ir. Is degenerate and unrestrained, and thus shall be rejected and abolished as a population center, enduring anguish and terror in the process. Now this was written, this verb, sur, was written in the hopeful stem, where this fate was foisted upon Damascus as a participle, that meaning that Damascus is going to come to embody this depiction of unrestrained corruption. So it is a place that has become corrupt. And boy, is that ever true. Look at the Islamic world. And as a result of that, this fate is going to be foisted upon them, and they're going to be removed from among inhabited cities. Now, that's a pretty bold statement, because Damascus was the longest inhabited, continuously inhabited city in the world. It still is. Just that it's not going to last much longer. I would say perhaps a decade. And she, speaking of Damascus, shall totally and actually become, this is in the call perfect, so it means I'm speaking literally here. And perfect means this act is complete and total. And she shall totally and actually become a twisted and tangled, this is ma'i, a distorted, crooked, perverted, and contorted heap of rubble. Mafala, a destroyed ruin from nafal, something that has fallen prostrate. You know, it's the Islamic prostration prayers, something that is overthrown and becomes unworthy, inferior. So Damascus is not just going to become uninhabitable for having been corrupt, but it's going to become a twisted and tangled heap of rubble, according to Yahweh. Now, there's two possibilities here. One of them is the most logical, which is that the Sunni Mujahideen that are being sponsored by the United States, Europe, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar are going to ultimately outgun and outman the Assad regime, operating in concert with Iran and with China and Russia, and that the Sunni Muslims will prevail, and that they will prevail by being destructive. You know, for the most part, Muslims don't conquer. They destroy. And that's what's being predicted here, that these Muslims aren't going to conquer Damascus. They're going to destroy Damascus. And that is what we're witnessing. Almost all of the suburbs of Damascus are already rendered as a heap of twisted and tangled rubble. Now, the second option is not nearly as positive, not that you could call a terrorist onslaught positive. But if you've seen the pictures of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, or just the pictures of Dresden in Germany and Tokyo in Japan and other places that have been carpet bombed, or those that have been received a nuclear bomb, the recipients of a nuclear bomb. In the immediate aftermath, what you do see is a twisted and tangled heap of rubble. Now, the steel bends, and the weight of the force of the blast that just causes everything to be twisted and tangled, distorted and crooked and perverted and contorted. And so there is the possibility that the Iranians, who either already have or are on the brink of having a nuclear bomb, once they are recognized that there is no chance of saving Damascus, that Hezbollah and the Assad regime collectively have gone down in defeat, rather than simply walk away and say, well, you know, you win some, you lose some, there is a distinct possibility that the Iranians will deploy a nuclear bomb just to lash out at the Sunni Mujahideen sponsored by the United States, Europe, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, and say, take that. You wanted it so bad? Here, you can have it. That is a distinct possibility here. Yahweh isn't sympathetic toward the display of Islamic terrorism he is witnessing in Damascus. Sur, which was translated revolting and corrupt, and will be removed, can be rendered turned away and abolished, degenerate and forsaken, even rejected as wild and unrestrained. Similarly, conveys more than just inhabited city, because it also speaks of anguish, anxiety, wrath, anger, and terror. Islam is the most overtly satanic religion ever foisted on the masses. The most degenerate and revolting corruption to be considered a mainstream religion. Also worth considering is the juxtaposition of Ma'i and Mapala, which collectively depict the nature of Muslim terrorists, currently reducing Damascus to a heap of ruins. They, in addition to the suburbs of Damascus, are twisted, distorted, corrupt, and perverted. They're also subject to prostration, which is what the Muslims do, even in the midst of their terrorist acts. Five times a day, they will bow in prostration towards Mecca and Allah. And inexcusably, these jihadists are wielding American weapons when they are not prostrating themselves in prayer, staining the American consciousness with the murder of over 150,000 souls. In the process, the United States is making Israel more vulnerable to the onslaught of Allah's caustic religion. We have Kirk having called in. It's been about a week or so since we've heard from you, Kirk. It's wonderful to have you back. Hoping that you have an insight or a comment regarding the initial statement that God has made regarding Damascus.
Yes, sir. I wanted to ask you a question about it. If I think later, doesn't it say that the animals graze there?
Well, you know, it's
so. I mean, it's.
I know that that is that is a popular rendering of the terminology that God has selected. I don't get that at all. That what I get, and we're going to will be at it in a moment, as I translated the words, what I get is roaming bands of animals, in the sense of men acting more like animals than humans, and that these marauding bands are not of wolves and jackals and the like.
But a metaphor.
Instead a metaphor for Islamic jihadists. I'm sure you've seen the pictures that Islamic jihadists like to take of themselves, screaming Allahu Akbar and blowing people to smithereens as they cut off the heads of those they oppose. Yeah, it's pretty hard to see them as human, and they and seeing them as depraved animals is really appropriate.
What's in the psyche of somebody? You know, when people go off to war and they return from war, they want to settle down and stop doing that, and they want to build a nation or rebuild a nation or build their businesses back. And
right.
What is in a psyche? I know I've listened to you for 6 years.
Yeah. I'm so sorry. I apologize.
No,
I know. I'm just kidding.
I know what the answer, but it just doesn't ring true that people would just want to go back when they leave Damascus. They're going to go home and keep going. So, I mean,
of course. Yeah, that is the because what we're going to lead up to here is that. Don't mind. We'll go back and we'll pick up the story, but it's okay to jump ahead. God jumped ahead. I mean, he's told us what's going to happen, so we're talking about jumping ahead, so it's appropriate to do so.
All right.
God has told us emphatically in the statements that we're going to read here in a moment that the Sunni jihadists are going to prevail over the Shiites and that the government of Damascus is going to fall. So he's told us who's going to win. Assad's going to lose. The Iranians are going to lose. Really, the whole world loses. Everybody loses. That's the nature of Islam. And the Sunnis are going to prevail, and the country is going to fall. Now, the reason that what you've just said is interesting is because immediately after we're told that Syria falls, we're told that Israel is sliced in two. And there's a treaty that sacrifices Israeli land for promises of peace that makes the country indefensible. And so you have to say, how do you go from the fall of the Syrian government to the immediate divestiture of Israel of its midsection so that it's no longer viable as a country in the same day? And essentially it says in that day. So it's an immediate act. And you've hinted at it, and I think there is an analog for us to examine that explains how this is going to happen. And that is, if you look at the proxy war that America fought in Afghanistan, first Afghanistan, not second Afghanistan, where we rented Al-Qaeda and the Taliban from the Pakistani government and then provided them with $5 billion of weapons, and they ultimately prevailed over the secular government in Afghanistan. What did those jihadists do once they had prevailed and they went back to their country? Did they set down their weapons?
They wanted to go invade Iraq.
Well, that, and they also committed a decade of terrorist acts. Syria, as we know, is a client of Iran, just as is Iraq, thanks to America's ill-fated invasion. And by way of Hezbollah, which means Allah's party, the religious regime in Iran also controls Lebanon, creating a land crescent from Iran into northern Israel, facilitating one aspect of the Islamic invasion that prophecy predicts. But a thoughtful review of the whole of Yah's testimony indicates that in 2027, a year after the affirmation of a peace treaty with many nations, and perhaps as late as the fall of 2026, Muslims are going to disregard the promises of peace that they have made with Israel, where they have confiscated Israel's land, where they have made Israel more vulnerable, and they're going to form what Yahweh calls the Magog Federation. And it's going to include a number of countries, united Iran, Iraq, Syria, Pakistan, the formerly, the recently formed Islamic states in the Caucasus regions of the former Soviet Union, of which there's a score of, Turkey, to name a few. Gog, who is a Muslim cleric and warlord from the area west of the Caspian Sea, will ally with Egypt, Libya, Algeria, and the Sudan, among others. And in unison, they're going to attack Israel using American weapons. Over the past decade, under the Bush administration and then Obama, the United States has fundamentally changed the balance of power in the region by providing Muslims with 25 times more military hardware than is offered to God's chosen people. You know, Kirk, I don't think many Americans are aware that the United States provides 25 times more war material to Muslims who want to destroy Israel than it does to Israel.
But no, I think that's the illusion that they used to be where we used to give them a lot of stuff, you know, and they still believe that, but obviously everyone I talk to, they would be astounded by that, I think.
Yeah, I think astounded by it. And it's not just a little bit more. I mean, it's 25 times more. I looked at all of the arms shipments of the United States over the past decade. And when you total them all up, it's 25 times more weaponry to the Islamic nations surrounding Israel than it is to Israel. So we've put Israel in a position where it can no longer defend itself. Once it becomes vulnerable and the next time Muslims attack in unison, the Israeli IDF will not be able to defend the nation. That's what we have done. And to soften it up, to make it especially vulnerable, this treaty is going to be formed where Israel is shrunk at the waist. So the United States is a huge player in this. And we're not on the right side.
Speaking of that, and, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, destruction of cities and all, when the terrorist attack large cities in the West,
preferably, yes.
Mm-hmm. Especially in the United States. On the timeline, when are you, and I don't know if anybody knows exactly, but on the, when do you think that would be happening? And, well, and the reason I ask is because in a discussion you've been doing in the last few weeks is if the Yehudim are returning to Israel,
mm-hmm.
and if America was going to be attacked and destroyed cities, and with I would think the big targets being on the East Coast and perhaps Los Angeles on the West Coast. I mean, there's huge Jewish populations
mm-hmm.
in New York and all, and it would hardly happen before that event, would it?
Yeah, what's interesting is, as I went back through and systematically retranslated all of the statements that are found in Yashia 17 and 18, what I have come to realize is that the immediate aftermath of sacrificing Israel does not occur in the United States. It occurs in Israel. And it's Israeli cities, particularly in the Northern Kingdom, that are ransacked and destroyed. And at that point, God has not removed the Jewish population of America. And he only waits until the last hour when it's obvious that Israel is going to crumble and fall to this tidal wave of Muslims, that he literally blows the Muslims out of Israel, destroying them. That at that point, God announces that he waited to the last minute because the Israelis had forgotten him, that they were unwilling to rely on him. And so he waited to the last minute. It became obvious that they were going to fail. And it's only after all of this that America is mentioned. And then God gives us a stern warning, woe, and he speaks directly of America. And it appears that America does something even more heinous than what we've already done, more awful than slicing Israel into pieces and supporting the countries that are her enemies.